And welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today from the National Organization on Disability, we have its president, Carol Glazer. Carol, welcome.
Thank you, Laura. Good to be here.
Let's go over your street cred here. You joined the organization back in 06 as the executive director of its National Employability Partnership, and you became the president. Gosh, it's been 10 years now, so that's quite a long time there.
Time has flown by.
And I am sure that you are capable of giving us a real quick, though, first the elevator speech, and then let's talk about the history of NOD and what it's doing for all of us.
Okay, so our elevator speech about our mission is we promote the good quality of life for America's 57 million people with disabilities.
That says it all. One of my questions was going to be, how many people are actually affected by your organization or could use it? 57 million of us.
That's one in five of us.
One in five. Now, what counts as a disability when we're talking about employment? Is this something that... Is there a set definition?
It's anything that interferes with your ability to perform major life activities. So that can include mental health issues. That can include other types of invisible disability like autism, neurological disorders. And then, of course, there are physical disabilities like paralysis, people who use wheelchairs, people who have had cancer, people who have or have had cancer. Are all considered people with disabilities. Hypertension, high blood pressure, asthma. It really covers a very wide swath of the American population.
Well, what's the history of the National Organization on Disability, NOD?
Yeah, we were created in 1982. That was 36 years ago. And at that time, that was 8 years before the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was modeled after the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And so at that point, people with disabilities had very little power. They had very little ability to participate in community life, in the workforce, in civic life. And so NOD was established in order to start just dealing with basic quality of life issues.
Well, when you talk about quality of life issues, you're not focusing on housing or transportation, et cetera, are you? You're more dedicated towards employment, are you?
Well, now we're dedicated towards employment, but over the years we have evolved pretty much the same way the disability rights movement has evolved, in the sense that people couldn't, if they were in a wheelchair, people could not cross the street. There were no curb cuts. People couldn't get into buildings. You couldn't go to the church. Or the theater, or to sports venues, or inside office buildings. And so in those days, it was important to get people simple access to the things that you or I might take for granted as our God-given rights. But at that time, people with disabilities didn't have those rights. And so anybody who was working in this field that goes back that long had to take care of all of those thresholds that we've reached as a society in our view of disability.
Well, of course, you can't very well hold a job if you cannot get to your job because there's no transportation available to you, and if you can't open the door or get your chair in or find a guide into it.
Exactly.
So has the ADA, obviously it's helped there with your hardscape, but has it helped then with the actual planting the trees and getting the jobs and all of that?
It's funny, you know, you talk about transportation, and the progress of the disability rights movement very much mirrors the progress of the civil rights movement in this country. And so where African Americans talk about how they fought for the right to sit in the front of the bus, people with disabilities have fought for the right to simply get on the bus. And so when you talk about where we are now, having reached many milestones and where many parts of transportation are accessible, but many parts are still not accessible. I live in New York City. The New York City subway system is impossible to navigate if you depend on a wheelchair to get around. So those transportation issues that you're talking about still have a ways to go. But we feel that the single biggest barrier to a good quality of life for people with disabilities at this point in history is their lack of an ability to participate in the workforce. And the percentage of people with working age people with disabilities in the workforce varies anywhere between 20 and 40%, depending on how you count and who you count. But that number hasn't changed since well before the ADA. And so because we are a considered a small to medium-sized nonprofit organization, with a corporate boards love focus. Our board decided about 10 years ago, and that's when I came into NOD, that we would bet the ranch, if you will, that we would put the soul of our efforts into trying to do something about that employment number.
And now you, so if one in five could identify as having a disability, you're saying that underemployment or unemployment is 20 to 40%? I missed that little bit there.
Yes, that's right. The employment is 20 to 40%.
And so, then obviously good jobs.
Good jobs are even more scarce. The jobs that people do get, people with disabilities, they don't pay as well. It took them twice as long to find that job, and they're twice as likely to be out of that job if an employer reaches a reduction in force. So this is a highly vulnerable population. Poverty rates are anywhere between two and three times the rate of the general population or other minority groups. And it stands to gain. If you're not working, chances are you're going to have a lot of trouble making ends meet financially. The dominant way that we thought about disability in this country until very, very recently was a charity approach, what we call in the wonk world an income maintenance approach. The idea is, well, you can't work. You can't necessarily even get to work because you can't make it in the subway system. And so because of that, we're going to take care of you. But we're going to do it at a basic subsistence level that keeps you just above the poverty line. And by the way, the benefits are set up so that if you get a job, you stand to lose those benefits. We call it the cash cliff in our field. So we're talking about a vulnerable population that has been seen for most of history, even modern history, as a charity case.
And you mentioned when we were discussing what counts as a disability, and so many of these are hidden. I mean, you can hide some hearing loss. You can hide asthma and heart conditions and a cancer history like that. So why are we not, and we obviously know that the guy sitting next to you at your desk or the lady down the hallway or even your bus driver, et cetera, mm-hmm. they are disabled but not speaking up or counting
right.
in this. So it's a hidden population that there might be even more.
Yes, exactly. And it's a one single word explanation for that, Laura, and the word is stigma. We think about fears and myths and stereotypes. So what are employers afraid of? They're afraid that somebody with a disability is going to have more absences or going to have higher health care costs, or the accommodations costs are going to be extraordinary, when in fact what we know about accommodations costs is that 75% of them are about less than $500. So you're talking about fears of, and none of the other fears, frankly, have been borne out in reality. People with disabilities who are hired tend to last longer in jobs, maybe because it's harder to find the next one. They tend to have better attendance records. They tend to have equal productivity, in some cases better productivity. And they tend to boost the morale of the rest of the workforce as opposed to what many employers feel, which is, well, their coworkers aren't going to know how to talk to them. How do you talk to somebody in a wheelchair? Do you stand up? Do you kneel down? How do you talk to somebody who doesn't have a hand when you meet them? Do you hold your hand out to shake their hand with their other hand? So those are the kinds of fears. And then we have the stereotypes. Well, somebody who has a mental health condition is going to so-called go postal. They're going to have some sort of a go on the rampage, which in reality is true for such a very, very small percentage of people who have, say, post-traumatic stress disorder. So those are the fears, those are the myths, and then the stereotypes. And all of that is really wrapped up in the stigma of disability, which is still very prevalent in modern-day society.
Well, there went one of my major questions. You want to dispel the myths involved in hiring at this point. And you know, and it's interesting because I've had the American Diabetes Association comes in every now and then, and one of the things he talks about is the stigma. And I go, what's the stigma? He goes, well, if people know that you have this, they find that almost as if it's a personal, problem that you have. It's a lack of a discipline,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. So they keep it quiet. And there's
right.
because and employment was one of the big areas that
That's
he discusses
right.
on that. But
yes.
then when you hit upon mental health issues,
yes.
et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a partnership with the U.S. Army. And before the show began, I mentioned, well, we're creating disabled veterans and we're creating vets
That's
that are
correct.
Out there in
we're
the job field.
Country.
And they have to face this same issue as well because everyone is so nervous around
That's right.
Our military.
That's right. In the days of World War II and even up to Vietnam, we talked about combat fatigue. We talked about shell shock. But what both of those terms mean is post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's a condition that is very prevalent. The estimates are anywhere between a half and two-thirds of veterans coming back from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are going to come back with post-traumatic stress disorder. And, yes, it's highly stigmatized. We tend to just have these fears of people with that condition as I say, going postal. Don Rumsfeld, to his credit, it's one of the things he did that was positive. I'm not making any political commentary here. But indeed, it was Donald Rumsfeld who felt that the Army veterans coming back from these wars should get taken care of in a way that was higher quality than what the Veterans Administration could provide. And he also believed that these veterans, no matter how disabled they are, many and most of them could in fact participate in the workforce. But he knew that in order to make that happen, the Army was going to have to give a little bit of extra support. And it was in that context that he set up something called the Wounded Warrior Program within the U.S. Army, and he reached out to our organization, NOD, to help him build an employment cell within that Wounded Warrior Program. And we did that. We did it through what was designed as a three-year demonstration in three cities and ended up being a seven-year project in four cities, one of them, in fact, in Pittsburgh. And we showed that with the right kind of support, veterans, even with the most serious disabilities, could participate in a meaningful way, both in the workforce and in school.
Are there incentives for someone to hire within the disabled population? Is there any type of tax break, or is it just that you are going to get a great employee and boost the morale of the staff that you currently have?
Yes, you know, we talk about the fact that the numbers that we cite that are they're mind-boggling indeed. Those numbers are not only an injustice; it's not only a social justice issue. It's really a huge waste of talent that could be enriching the American workforce. We think about the fact that unemployment rates are at historically low levels right now, lower than they've been in a half a century. Where is industry going to find this talent? And in this case, it's in their own backyard with that anywhere from 60 to 80% of working-age Americans with disabilities who aren't working. People who spend their lives navigating a world that wasn't built for them, who have to solve problems, who have to develop workarounds, who have to be persistent, tenacious. These are all the in-demand skills in today's workforce. And with employment at such historically high levels and businesses needing to seek new so-called untapped labor forces, here's one that's right under their nose. And so, again, this is not just about a social justice issue. This is really about a huge waste of talent that impedes our economic progress as a nation.
If you are just joining us, this is Focus on the Delaware Valley, and I'm Laura Lewis. With us today, the president of the National Organization on Disability, Carol Glazer. If you'd like more information about what we are talking about today, find out more about their mission, find out more about their programming and employment, go to NOD.org. That's NOD.org, and you'll find everything right there. So we've talked about all of the stigma. We've talked about the myths of hiring. But we didn't talk about then, well, why aren't they hiring? What are some of the problems that that businesses are having? If you can dispel all of those myths that they're going to have to spend a fortune on accommodation or that it's going to affect their productivity, if you've already dismissed that, well, what's wrong? Why aren't they making the connection and going, duh, I should tap this workforce?
So if we could just do a very quick run through history, Laura. Think about disability up until the 1990s, really, 1990 when the ADA was passed. Historically, disability was viewed as a medical problem that rested with the individual and that full participation in the workforce or in civic or community life would depend on a person getting cured or getting so-called overcoming the disability. We call that the medical model. People with mental health or cognitive issues were institutionalized where they could be so-called cared for by specially trained people. And people with physical disabilities where there are no curb cuts, if somebody used a wheelchair, they really couldn't leave their home. So for most of modern history, most people simply didn't see or encounter people with disabilities unless they were in their own family. And if they were, again, the kind of disability that forced people to be institutionalized, my son Jacob, who's now 26 years old, born with a brain defect, would have been sent off to Willowbrook had he been born 20 years before he was. And so if you think about the ADA creating curb cuts, suddenly now people with wheelchairs are seen out and about in their neighborhoods. And when you think about the movement to deinstitutionalize those who had been sent off, that movement being successful in getting people back into their communities, suddenly now we have a new experience with this population that nobody really ever understood before. And with the disability rights movement that grew up around the civil rights movement, the push was to move away from this medical model, was to say, disability is a normal part of the human condition. It's something any of us could experience at any time. And the responsibility to include people with disabilities into civic life and the workforce really rests with society and not with the individual with disabilities. And that was a whole new way of looking at disability. Some refer to it as a civil rights model or the social model. So really, employers are no different than the rest of society, and suddenly getting to experience this brand new population, not understanding it very well, coming to have to see it in a different way from the old medical model. And we're still in that point where employers are just now coming around, because they have to understanding that this is a talent segment that could be enriching their workforce.
Are they just not meeting them? Are they unaware of them? What I know you have a program that you have to explain to me now, Bridge to Business. What are some of the impediments to getting that interview?
Sure. With any new workforce, you think about women and some of the stereotypes there when women were entering the workforce in the 60s and 70s. Oh, well, a woman is too emotional. She can't do a hard management job. Or, oh, well, women are going to go have babies. They'll be absent too much. And, of course, all of those stereotypes were disproven. Think about racial and ethnic minorities and all of the things that people have been afraid about hiring African-Americans or Latinos. And so in incorporating any of those new workforces, employers had to go up a learning curve. Where do you find people? What kind of jobs can people do? How do you deal with some of these fears that we have that are simply based on wrong-headed thinking and information? And so people with disabilities are really no different from any new segment of the workforce. So employers have to be disabused of some of the concerns that they've had that are not grounded in reality. No, their health care costs won't go up. Yes, there are many jobs that people with disabilities can do. I often get asked, what kind of jobs can people with disabilities do? And I have to say, well, what kind of jobs can people do? Because the population is that heterogeneous and it is that able to succeed in the workforce. So you got to conquer some of those stereotypes. You have to learn how to incorporate this new talent segment. You have to know where to find people. And with disability, you have to start understanding different modalities in the way that either people communicate or learn. Somebody who's blind can be incredibly talented and intelligent and able to tune into an enormous number of things that people who are not blind can. But you have to start presenting new information in a new way. Fortunately, with blind people and people who have visual or hearing impairments, their technology is a miraculous leveler of the playing field for people with disabilities. So you have to start learning how people learn, how to onboard people, how to help them grow professionally and advance in their careers. And all of that is a learning curve that many employers, fortunately, are now putting themselves on, and all of them are recognizing the payoffs.
And what is Bridge to Business? I know that you cite businesses that do get it. And correct. Then we need to get into also campus to careers and preparing the disabled for real careers, real living wages, right. and success.
Yeah,
and so
exactly.
Let's jump in there and talk about these programs.
Well, sorry to go back to history again, but I'm a boomer, and so I've been around for a few years and have experienced many of the phases. With college students, the special education system was not created and in full force in this country until the early 1990s with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA. So our special ed system wasn't really invented and didn't start blossoming until the 90s. So you're now seeing the first generation of young people who went all the way through the special education system and are entering and graduating from college. But just going to college is still considered an enormous triumph in society and for this population. Trying to prepare these young people for the workforce, oh my God, it's just great that they're graduating from college. Our job is over. And that's unfortunately how many colleges and universities and even parents are thinking. But hey, guess what? If you assume these kids can actually go into the workforce when they leave college, which we know they can, then you have to start preparing them the way you prepare all other students. And so lo and behold, the number of college graduates with disabilities in this country who are not working is still at a rate of anywhere between 40 and 60%. So we've got to do something to turn those numbers around. And now, again, with the search for talent, companies are saying, where do I find these individuals who are ready to go to work, who are graduating from college for these mid-level professional positions? They go on campus, and what they find is that schools aren't preparing the kids to interview and to go into the workforce, and you've got to make a connection. And that's where we come in. We create these bridges from campuses to careers, the same way we create bridges from communities to careers for people who are not necessarily college graduates. The whole idea is matching supply of labor with the demand for it with a new workforce that employers don't necessarily understand.
And how do you do this?
Well, the first thing we do is we come on site with an employer and we try to understand their culture. We look at their job descriptions. We look for ways they might be inadvertently screening out people with disabilities by looking for too much experience. I always tell an employer, you're looking for 10 years of experience. Well, how about 10 years navigating the streets of New York City in a wheelchair? That ought to mean something. That person does not have zero experience that's relevant to their productivity. And so you've got to see where employers might be inadvertently screening out talent simply by the way they look for skills in their job descriptions. Then you have to find the agencies that can help them source the talent. And this is a whole new alphabet soup. This is agencies like Goodwill or the ARC or Catholic Charities or United Cerebral Palsy or any number of other organizations that have grown up in order to help prepare people with disabilities for the workforce, veterans organizations who are doing that. Well, for employers, this is a whole new world they're navigating. And so what we do is we, understanding their labor force needs, we go out and we find the best places for them to source that talent. Then we make the match, and we work both sides of it. We tell employers that they're going to have to get a job coach, for example, for somebody who has no labor force experience. And we help them understand what a job coach does, and a job coach is going to work themselves out of a job at some point. So there's, again, that learning curve that we help employers navigate, and we also help the talent sourcing agencies to understand what businesses' labor force needs are. Because many of these agencies did not grow up with an expectation that their clientele or their participants were going to go into the workforce. And so now we have to teach them how to speak the language of business, how to market their clients' strengths and not their deficits, how not to present a charity case, but to present somebody who's fully capable of participating in the workforce.
And, of course, you do this with great partnerships, as you just mentioned, all of those. Do you have a good housekeeping seal of approval for businesses, or do you recognize businesses or some of the ones that, as I said, do get it and are hiring well?
Yes, we do. We think the carrot approach is a good approach, and we have a tool called the Disability Employment Tracker, which is a confidential self-assessment tool that employers can access for free, and we use the results of that 80-question survey to identify the best and the brightest, the top quartile, give or take, of the now about 200 companies who take the tracker. And yes, we issue a leading disability employer award that we award annually. We just awarded the seal for this year. We call it Disability Employment Seal. And we just did that last month in Washington with a big extravaganza because we do like to celebrate the employers who are doing great work. I should say we're also debuting as part of this a new awareness campaign, because all of the things, and this ties together everything we've been talking about so far, but it's really a way of saying, don't look at this pool of people as a charity case. Look at this pool of people as a talent source that could be enriching your workforce. And if we're really going to change the numbers, we know that we're going to have to dispel some of those myths. We're going to have to deal with stigma. And that's what's really ultimately going to get people back into the workforce. And that awareness campaign that we call Look Closer is a way of saying to employers, if you don't see somebody who's got problem-solving skills, tenacity, perseverance, then you should look closer.
Oh, we are out of time, and that is absolutely the perfect way to wrap this thing and bring it home there. Look closer. And if I'm a business, I'm hearing this, I'm going to go to your website, and I'm going to discover ways that I can improve my workforce.
Please do. Go to our website and go to Look Closer, and you'll see a whole bunch of tools and techniques and practices that you can use.
And this is for the small employer or the biggest employer in your city. And, of course, that website is NOD.org. That's NOD.org for National Organization on Disability, NOD.org. And my guest today, it's President Carol Glaser. Carol, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Laura. I'm glad you're covering this issue. Very important.
We all learned something today, that's for sure. NOD.org, the place to go. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus.